All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Namo Om Vishnu Padaya. Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vinata Swami Niti Namani. Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pacharni Nivasesis and Nivandi Paspachavi Satarni Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Guru and Vaishnavacha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Sam Sajivam Sadvoitam Sadvadutam Padijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Vitam Sta Manchakalpa Jubascha Kripasindhuya Vita Padijanam Pavanevi Okaishanivam. Jai Jai Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda.
Jai Jai Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda.
Jai Advaita Chandra Jaya Gaura Bhaktavinda.
Jai Advaita Chandra Jaya Gaura Bhaktavinda.
Jai Jai Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda.
Jai Advaita Chandra Jaya
Gaura Bhaktavinda. It's May 28th, 2016 in Ypsilanti, Michigan. And we're reading from Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, Adi Leela, Chapter 2. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, text 91 to 92. Atraso sargo visargascha stanam poshanam utaya mandakare shanukata Niroda Muktir Ashraya Dasamasya Vishudyartam Navanami Halakshanam Varnayati Mahatmana Shrutanarjena Chandrasa. Atra. In Srimad Bhagavatam. Sargaha. The creation of the ingredients of the universe.
The creation of the ingredients of the universe.
Vishargaha.
Vishargaha.
The creations of Brahma.
The creations of Brahma.
Cha. And Stanam. The maintenance of the creation.
The maintenance of the creation.
Poshanam. The favoring of the Lord's devotees.
The favoring of the Lord's devotees.
Utayaha.
Utayaha.
Impetuses for activity. Manu Antara, prescribed duties given by the Manus. Isha Anukata, a description of the incarnations of the Lord. Niroda, the winding up of creation. Mukti, liberation. Ashrayaha, the ultimate shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Dashamasya, of the tenth, the Ashraya. Vishuddhi Artam, for the purpose of perfect knowledge. Navanam, of the nine. Iha, here. Lakshanam, the nature. Varnayanti, describe. Mahatmanaha,
the great souls.
Shrutena, by prayer. Artena, by explanation. Cha, and Anjasa, direct. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Here in Srimad Bhagavatam, 10 subjects are described. 1. The creation of the ingredients of the cosmos. 2. The creations of Brahma. 3. The maintenance of the creation. 4. Special favor given to the faithful. 5. Impetuses for activity. 6. Prescribed duties for law-abiding men. 7. A description of the incarnations of the Lord. 8. The winding up of the creation. 9. Liberation from gross and subtle material existence. And 10. The ultimate shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The 10th item is the shelter of all the others. To distinguish this ultimate shelter from the other 9 subjects, the Mahajanas have described these 9, directly or indirectly, through prayers or direct explanation. Purport. These verses are from Srimad Bhagavatam 2.10, 1-2. List the 10 subject matters dealt with in the text of the Bhagavatam. Of these, the 10th is the substance, and the other 9 are categories derived from the substance. What was the 10th? Ashraya, the shelter. Krishna, the shelter. So there's 10 topics in the Bhagavatam. In order for it to be a Purana, proper Purana, has to have these 10 topics. So the 10th is the main one, Ashraya, and the other 9 are supportive. So let's see if you can remember them, any of them, after we go through this list. Sanskrit or English is fine. Okay, the 10 subjects are listed as follows. Number 1, Sarga. This is the first creation by Vishnu, the bringing forth of the 5 gross material elements, the 5 objects of sense perception, the 10 senses, the mind, the intelligence, the false ego, and the total material energy or universal form. Number 2, Visarga, the secondary creation, or the work of Brahma in producing the moving and unmoving bodies in the universe, Brahmananda. 3, Sthana. What does sthana literally mean?
Place.
Place, or to stay. Very literal, the English word stay or stable. The maintenance of the universe by the personality of Godhead Vishnu. Vishnu's function is more important and his glory greater than Brahma's and Lord Shiva's. For although Brahma is the creator and Lord Shiva the destroyer, Vishnu is the maintainer. 4, Poshana. Anyone have any idea what Poshana means? Nourishment. Special care and protection for devotees by the Lord. As a king maintains his kingdom and subjects, but nevertheless gives special attention to the members of his family, so the personality of Godhead gives special care to his devotees who are souls completely surrendered to him. Uti, the urge for creation or initiative power that is the cause of all inventions according to the necessities of time, space, and objects.
Uti.
Uti. Uti. 6, Manvantara, the periods controlled by the Manus, who teach regulated principles for living beings who desire perfection in human life. The rules of Manu, as described in the Manu Samhita, guide the way to such perfection. Ishanukata, scriptural information regarding the personality of Godhead, his incarnations on earth, and the activities of his devotees. Scriptures dealing with these subjects are essential for progressive human life. 8, Nirodha, the winding up of all energies employed in creation. Such potencies are emanations from the personality of Godhead, who eternally lies in the Karna ocean. The cosmic creations manifested with his breath are again dissolved in due course. 9, Mukti, liberation of the conditioned souls encaged by the gross and subtle coverings of body and mind. When freed from all material affection, the soul, giving up the gross and subtle material bodies, can enter the spiritual sky in his original spiritual body and engage in transcendental loving service to the Lord in Vaikuntha Loka or Krishna Loka. When the soul is situated in his original constitutional position of existence, he is said to be liberated. It is possible to engage in transcendental loving service to the Lord and become a Jivan Mukta, a liberated soul, even while in this body. 10, Ashraya, the transcendence, the summum bonum, from whom everything emanates, upon whom everything rests, and in whom everything merges after annihilation. He is the source and support of all. The Ashraya is also called the Supreme Brahman, as in the Vedanta Sutra, Atato Brahma Jignasa Janmadyasya Yataha. Srimad Bhagavatam especially describes the Supreme Brahman as the Ashraya. Sri Krishna is this Ashraya, and therefore the greatest necessity of life is to study the science of Krishna. Srimad Bhagavatam accepts Sri Krishna as the shelter of all manifestations because Lord Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is the ultimate source of everything, the supreme goal of all. 2 different principles are to be considered herein, namely Ashraya, the object providing shelter, and Ashrita, the dependence requiring shelter. The Ashrita exists under the original principle, the Ashraya. The first 9 categories described in the first 9 cantos of Srimad Bhagavatam, from creation to liberation, including the Purusha avatars, the incarnations, the marginal energy or the living entities, and the external energy or material world, are all Ashrita. The prayers of Srimad Bhagavatam, however, aim for the Ashraya Tattva, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna. The great souls expert in describing Srimad Bhagavatam have very diligently delineated the other 9 categories, sometimes by direct narrations and sometimes by indirect narrations, such as stories. The real purpose of doing this is to know perfectly the absolute transcendent Sri Krishna, for the entire creation, both material and spiritual, rests on the body of Sri Krishna. Atra sargo visargascha sthanam poshanam utaya manvatare shanukata nirodo muktir ashraya dasamasya vishudartam navanam ihalakshanam varnayanti mahatmana shutenarchena chandrasa. Here in Srimad Bhagavatam, 10 subjects are described. 1. The creation of the ingredients of the cosmos. 2. The creations of Brahma. 3. The maintenance of the creation. 4. Special favor given to the faithful. 5. Impetuses for activity. 6. Prescribed duties for law-abiding men. 7. A description of the incarnations of the Lord. 8. The winding up of the creation. 9. Liberation from gross and subtle material existence. And 10. The ultimate shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The 10th item is the shelter of all the others. To distinguish this ultimate shelter from the other 9 subjects, the Mahajanas have described these 9 directly or indirectly through prayers or direct explanations. So, tell what are the 10 topics of the Bhagavatam? Anybody? Why don't you go around? Tell me one of them. Yes?
Ishanakata.
Ishanakata, which means?
Talks about the Supreme Personality.
Talks about the Supreme Personality. Got it. What's one of them?
Sarga.
Sarga, which is?
Creation.
Which creation?
The material world.
The first creation of the material world. The creation of material elements. Another one.
Is it the first creation or Visarga?
Visarga. That's the second creation by Lord Brahma. Another one?
Poshana. Poshana. Which is the nourishment.
Nourishment of the divinity.
Okay.
The number 3 is the maintenance of the material creation. I don't know the Sanskrit.
The maintenance of the material creation, yes?
Mukti.
Mukti or liberation. Yes, very good.
Sthana.
Hmm?
Sthana.
Sthana, which means the maintenance, to stay.
Oh, I thought that's
Poshana. Poshana is nourishment. Mm-hmm. So Poshana is the special care and protection, for especially for the devotees. And mm-hmm. Sthana is very related to the English word to stay. Mm-hmm. So of all the 10 topics, what is the most important? Which one have you mentioned?
Pastimes of Krishna.
Well, not exactly the pastimes of Krishna specifically, but Krishna himself. Ashraya, the ultimate shelter, which is Krishna. Now, are these 10 topics, can you say that Canto 1 has the first topic and Canto 2 has the second topic? Is it like that? No. The topics are throughout the Bhagavatam, but of course, especially what Canto deals with Ashraya. The 10th. But not exclusively. We find talks about Krishna throughout the Bhagavatam. In fact, why don't we go through here and see where we can find these different topics. So Sarga, the first creation by Vishnu, where is this described in the Bhagavatam? Especially the second canto. And also a little bit, where else?
Third canto.
Third canto, yeah.
Fifth canto.
What?
Fifth canto
also a little bit. And 11th canto also a little bit. The second creation of Lord Brahma, where is that described?
Second canto.
Again, second, where else? Sixth canto. Where in the sixth canto? Relationship to the daughters of Daksha. No, fourth and sixth canto, and again 11th canto. Third, fifth also, a lot in the fifth about the creation of Brahma. Okay, sthana, maintenance, where is that being described?
I don't really understand this concept.
What is the concept of maintenance? How Lord Vishnu is maintaining the material world. Where would you say that is described?
It's everywhere.
It's everywhere, okay. Let's get some specific. It's everywhere. We should be able to give some specific instances. There's some places that are more than one topic. So. How Lord Vishnu is maintaining everything.
I guess first and second canto again.
Okay, can we give some specific stories that are related to the maintenance, how Lord Vishnu is maintaining the universe?
Well, when Varaha lifts up.
Okay, Varaha lifts the earth, definitely. Some other with maintenance.
Saving
the demigods and the demons. Okay, can you give me some stories of saving the demigods and the demons?
Like
Vamandev. Okay, what's another one?
Kurma,
okay.
Nisinga
Avatar, yes, another one.
Mohini Murti.
Mohini Murti, yes. Singing also with when Lord Shiva destroyed the flying spaceships, and Lord Vishnu came as a cow, and with Shiva as a calf, and they drank all the nectar, so Mahadhanava couldn't create a problem. Vitrasura, a nice one about maintenance. I think also we could say in the fifth canto, the movements of the planets have something to do with the maintenance. The prayers of the residents of Jambudvipa. Okay, Poshana, special care and protection for the devotees, where the Lord protects his devotees. So where is this discussed in the Bhagavatam?
Ambarish.
Okay, Ambarish and Durvasa.
Prahlad.
Dhruva. Some more protection of the devotees.
Nandamaraj
with the snake and with Varuna.
Govardhan
Lila.
Parikshit
in the womb, yes. In the first canto.
And the Pandavas in general.
The Pandavas in general, which are mostly in the first canto, and somewhat in the tenth. Then Uti, the urge for creation, the impetus to do things, why we do things, what gives us impetus to do things.
Lord Brahman's canto.
Okay.
Prithu Maharaj in the fourth canto.
Prithu Maharaj, okay. It's a lot about impetus, why we do things, what's our creative urge. Some more.
Vidura and Maitreya.
Okay. Some more. What about Daksha? And the Hamsaguya prayers? Is that about impetus for activity? What about Paruruva, urgency? Agnija, is that about impetus for activity? What drives us? Forest of material enjoyment, Jed Bharat Maharaj Rahuvina, that whole section. Manvantara, so the Manus and their rules, the rules of morality.
Fourth canto.
Yes, okay. And what else does somebody say?
I mentioned the eighth canto beginning.
The eighth canto beginning? Okay, where else do we have rules? There's a couple chapters, there's a few, two or three chapters maybe, specifically about rules for human beings.
Narada describes the ideal society in the seventh.
Yes, in the seventh canto. Narada Muni describes the varnas, the ashrams, the perfect person. There's quite a lot in the 11th canto about rules for living.
Would you count the Uddhava Gita?
Yes, definitely. There's a lot in the Uddhava Gita about the modes of material nature and the rules for living. What about the story of Ajamil? That's also rescuing the devotees, but there's a lot of rules for living in a negative way in the story of Ajamil. The description of the hellish planets, the description of the heavenly planets. That's something about the rules for living. And then, of course, there's all the genealogies of all of the Manus. So the Manus and their rules. Okay? Ishanu Kata. So the information of the Lord's incarnations.
Second canto, chapter 7.
Okay, second canto, chapter 7, scheduled incarnations
first
with specific
canto,
functions.
Three.
First canto, chapter 3. What else? What incarnations are described in the Bhagavatam? Let's name them. An incarnation that's described in the Bhagavatam.
Parashuram.
Who else?
Rama.
Lord Ramachandra. Who else?
Manus.
Manus was under Manvantara.
And Vamandev.
Vamandev. What other incarnation?
Varaha.
What other incarnation? Jake.
Vyasadeva.
Another one.
Nrsingadev.
Nrsingadev, right. And then there's Prithu, Rishabhdev, Okay. Hamsa Avatar is also mentioned. What's more? Yajna. What's the incarnation Yajna? What, Kurma Avatar? What's Achi Muni's son, whose incarnation? Dattatreya, right? Any other incarnations that are mentioned that I've forgotten? Four Kumaras, Narada are also Saktivesa avatars.
Buddha?
Buddha, least mentioned, yes. Okay, then Nirodha, destruction.
Lord Shiva's destruction.
Lord Shiva, where is it described?
Fifth canto of the scriptures.
Okay. Where else is there some description of destruction of the universe?
Little,
okay. Where else? Matsya Avatar? What about, what's his name? Markandeya Rishi? Destruction of the universe, and even the death of Maharaj Bricket is kind of destruction. Unless we have anything about destruction. And then, mukti, liberation, and Prabhupada makes the point that liberation can also be within this life. It doesn't have to just be in death. So where in the Bhagavatam are the descriptions of liberation? Oh, very nice. Narada Muni is lightning and illumination occur simultaneously when he gets his spiritual body. Where else do we have descriptions of liberation?
Dhruva Maharaj.
Dhruva Maharaj, going back to about it. Where else? Ajamil, yes.
Priyavata's son.
Oh, okay, very good.
Rasta, you like rule about it.
What's the name of the king that in a moment?
I don't remember. Yeah, that king who...
Rahugana
got liberated in this life. There was that king who became liberated in a moment.
Yeah.
In the Puranjana story, King Malayadwaj became liberated. There's actually a lot of instances.
Yeah. Did Dhritarashtra got liberated?
Did Dhritarashtra. I think
he
that...
died also.
What?
He died also.
He also died. I think one of the most interesting is Ila and Sujumna in the ninth canto. And he went back to Godhead. He became they also liberated in this life. We have, of course, the Pandavas who were liberated in this life.
The gopis who couldn't go see Krishna.
The gopis who were prevented from seeing Krishna. Okay, very good. Then Ashraya, the personality of Godhead. Of course, everything in the tenth canto and everywhere that Krishna is described. And it says here that these things are described directly and indirectly. So directly, it's just statements of fact and philosophy, and Prabhupada says indirectly means through stories. By the way, what is the more powerful way for us to learn, directly or indirectly through stories? Indirectly through stories. So in every culture of the world, the culture has been passed down to the next generation and retained within the society through stories. And we find the Bhagavatam, like most of the Puranas, are full of stories. So why are stories more powerful ways of learning and remembering things than philosophy?
You can apply them to your life.
Yeah.
They're personal.
They're very personal.
It's because of our nature.
Definitely, it's our nature. Krishna loves stories. We're part of Krishna. So, I mean, Krishna's whole existence is just one lila, one story after another. So we also really like stories. And as part of his eightfold pastimes, he listens to stories at least every evening. There's some entertainment, mm-hmm. and there's stories. Mother Yasoda tells him bedtime stories about himself, of course. Oh, Krishna, I'm going to tell you the story of Lord Ramachandra. You'll like this story very much. So Krishna likes to be in stories and hear stories. That's basically all that he does. So we also really love stories. Any other reason why stories are more effective than just straight philosophy?
In Kali Yuga, I guess the tendency is to be less philosophical.
Definitely. In Kali Yuga, we're not so philosophically inclined. I mean, I remember once it was Madhvacharya's appearance or disappearance day. I can't remember which it was. And I did a whole lot of research into Madhvacharya's philosophy. I prepared a very, very philosophical, scholarly class. It was at ISKCON Soho. And ISKCON Soho is one of the more scholarly temples. It's a place where if I ask people Shastra questions, I'm very likely to get a lot of people knowing the answer, which isn't true everywhere in the world. You can always tell how much people are studying the books by asking a few questions in class. Yeah. But within 10 minutes of my giving the class, I could see that I was losing the audience. People looked sort of glossy-eyed, you know. So I just completely drew out my class and spoke about something else. So most of us can't, we really can't absorb much philosophy. If it's a very philosophical purport and you ask afterwards, what was that about? Again, you get this sort of blank stares from people. Huh? And you find that the Bhagavatam is incorporating most of the philosophy into stories. In fact, you could say all of them into stories, because we have the stories of the sages at Namasharanya and the story of Maharaj Pariksit. So everything is within at least one story, and many things are stories within a story within a story, which modern psychology says is the best way we remember something. Also, stories bypass the conscious resistance. You know, if I just come up to you and say, hey, you're a terrible, sinful person, you're not going to accept that. But if I tell you a story
about a
terrible, sinful person, then you'll be able to hear it. Does that make sense to everybody?
Mm-hmm.
The Puranjana story. But in general, we're like that. That we can absorb and hear things in story form. That we would, because it just, we think, oh, it's a nice story, and we kind of relax, we put down our defenses. Whereas it's philosophy or direct instruction, all of our walls and guards come up, and we just think, well, I'm not going to listen to that. I'm going to protect my false ego. Also, very interesting in modern science, I'm sure you know that athletes are told to practice mentally. Yes, you all know that? Just visualize. So the tennis player is supposed to visualize hitting the ball. I mean, we all do this, don't we? If something's going to happen in our lives, don't we also prepare for it mentally?
You're going to go talk to someone about it.
Exactly.
Something.
And you visualize where you are and what you're going to be doing and what you're going to say and so forth. And they've hooked up, what is it called? EEGs? Can't remember. Yeah. This is EEG and this is EKG, right? So they hook up the EEGs to the brain of these athletes while they're visualizing themselves hitting the ball and running and so forth. And they find that the muscles of the body are being activated. The brain centers and the muscle centers in the body are being activated about 2/3 of what they would be if you were physically doing the activity. So when we hear stories, what happens is we identify with the characters in the story. And they've also done brain research like this. So if the character in the story picks up their jacket, then we have some brain activity as if we were picking up a jacket. Isn't that interesting? So when we're identifying with the characters in a story, this is one reason why when we're hearing a story or watching a movie or something like that, and the character's in trouble, that we get physiological symptoms. Our heart starts beating and we start sweating, right? You've all experienced this?
Yeah.
So when we're hearing stories, we are, in one sense, practicing whatever we're hearing. So as we hear stories about the devotees and the pious people and people getting liberated, it's as if we're practicing that with them, and we start imbibing those values. And because of the power of stories to educate and transform, stories transform culture. If you think about the huge cultural transformations that have happened in modern society, they've all been done through stories. And you can transform culture in positive and negative ways. If you think about abortion, for example, when I was a little girl, abortion was legal everywhere. Now, nobody made abortion legal by talking about what abortion is. You know, if you talked about the facts of abortion, nobody would have anything to do with it. But if you talk about some 13-year-old girl who gets raped and, oh, the poor girl, and she didn't know what to do, and she was so humiliated and traumatized, and she went to some, you know, illegal person and died, and then you go, oh! Do you understand?
Mm. You know,
exactly what they do. And this was done, I mean, it's a negative example. A positive example is with the environment. That, again, when I was young, to be ecologically minded was antisocial, because science and technology were saving the world. I mean, very much so. I mean, I remember watching Star Trek where they synthesized food on their computer. You know, they didn't have a garden up in the spaceship. And this was great. Antibiotics were going to save the world. Antibiotics and vaccines were going to conquer disease in the world. Seriously, when I was a little girl, this is the way it was presented. Chemical pesticides, chemical fertilizers were going to feed the world and eradicate poverty. So the whole world was going to be turned into heaven through science and technology. And, you know, to go around talking about the ecology and the environment was very antisocial. I remember I was in a protest march when I was 15 against pollution. And, you know, it was considered subversive by the government and by society in general. And it switched completely. Why? Because of stories. It started with Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, where she told stories of how it would become April and you wouldn't hear the birds, like we're hearing the birds now in May. You wouldn't hear the birds because the DDT, which eradicated, that's how malaria was eradicated in the United States, was through DDT. That DDT was weakening the eggshells of the birds. And so the little baby birds couldn't grow to maturity. And, you know, the stories of the farm workers who were spraying pesticides and they got all kinds of diseases and their babies were born deformed. And these stories is what started transforming society so that however, you know, green and ecological we may actually be is another question. But at least we've changed our paradigm. We've changed our values in society in ways that could never have been changed otherwise. So one of the primary ways of educating our children in Krishna consciousness and ourselves and keeping people enlivened is through our stories. And our stories also involve the stories we tell about our movement and our spiritual society, by the way. So, you know, like the GBC has a resolution that all first initiates should take vows of loyalty to ISKCON. If you want people to be loyal to a society, you're better off telling stories about how valuable the society is. And if we look around and listen, you know, what stories do we tell about our society? What stories do we tell about our temples and our communities and the other devotees? What are the stories? And these are going to lead us to something. So all of these things, all of these topics of the Bhagavatam, so told somewhat directly and other indirectly through stories. Again, even the direct instruction in the Bhagavatam, 100% of it is in the context of a story. It's Daksha who's saying the Hamsaguya prayers. You know, it's Sukadeva Goswami talking to Parikit, who's there fasting till death on the bank of the Ganga. You know, who's telling him this various philosophy. So all of these are meant to lead us to Krishna. That's the point. Even you could say Ishanukata, which is the talk of the other incarnations, is all meant to lead us to Krishna. We might say, well, that's directly Krishna. Well, no, not really. It's meant to lead us to Krishna. So everything that we do in our life, everything we talk about in our life, could be put in one of these categories, couldn't they? I mean, obviously, we're not doing much major creation. But we do sometimes take just sort of raw ingredients to create something, don't we? We have our chemical laboratory in the kitchen. Prabhupada said a good cook is a good chemist. So we do this sort of a very raw creation. Then we do a secondary creation. You know, raw creation, you're cutting the pieces of wood, and, you know, secondary creation, you're building the house. So we're doing these things, right? Stana, we maintain things. Poshana, we take care of other devotees. We take care of ourselves. We were talking about care and protection yesterday. Then urge, what's giving us impetus? What's giving us enthusiasm? What's motivating us? How do we motivate others? Then manvantara are about the rules. Gaurangi Priya yesterday was speaking so wonderfully about the relationship between morality and bhakti. It was definitely one of the more inspiring things I've heard from anybody probably in the last 10 years. And what is, you know, but we also want to be moral beings. It's not that in bhakti we all want to be, you know, immoral criminals. So what are our rules? What are our guiding principles? How do we function in the world? And we're concerned about this, yes? What am I supposed to do? How am I supposed to behave? We talked about Ishanukata, all the talks of all the incarnations of Krishna. Yesterday at Manashiksha, we were speaking how Raghunath Das Goswami says when we see Lord Chaitanya, we should see Krishna. Ausachi's son is Nanda Maharaj's son. And the same with all the incarnations. All the talks of all the devotees in the incarnations, we should see. There is the ultimate ashraya, mukti. So Of course, Raghunath Das Goswami, we were also saying yesterday, he said, talking about mukti is like a tigress that eats yourself. So when we're focused on mukti without ashraya, it becomes like a tigress. But when we're focused on the liberation of bhakti, then that is also leading us to the ashraya. Right? Bhakti liberates us from our selfishness. Like I was saying to Sri Arjuna, he was talking about being self-sacrificing. I said, the self you should sacrifice is the ahankara. You know, the pride, the lust, the arrogance, the selfishness. That's what's meant to be sacrificed. So that is our mukti. And finally, of course, the ashraya. So through these 10 topics of the Bhagavatam, told either in stories or within stories, are meant to bring us to our ultimate shelter. And similarly, everything in our life is meant to bring us to our ultimate shelter. If we're not connecting something in our life to our ultimate shelter, then we're in illusion. So we are meant to become living Bhagavatams. We are meant to become the person Bhagavatam. It's not just that Śrīla Prabhupāda is the person Bhagavatam and we're all supposed to be just, you know, ogres or something. So we're all supposed to be like that. As Prabhupada said in Geneva, chanting Hare Krishna means you make a diamond throne for Krishna in your heart and seat him there. He says you imagine. It's interesting. Prabhupada says you imagine that you have created a diamond throne in your heart and you're seating Krishna there, bathing him with Ganga and Jamuna water and dressing him and ornamenting him and worshipping him. And he says this is not false. It is factual. It is accepted. He said, so if you do this, chant Hare Krishna, meditate on Krishna, then everywhere you go, you become a tirtha. You become a holy place. We become living Bhagavatams. So people should see in our lives, in all these first 9 topics, how we create things from raw ingredients, how we create things secondary, how we maintain, how we protect ourselves and others, how we destroy things, our absorption in the pastimes of the Lord, how we try to function in this world, in our ashram, in our varna, in our relationships with other people. It should be obvious how all of this is leading to Krishna. And if we do this, then we are certainly factually liberated even in this life. And then Srila Prabhupada says there is really no material world. That we will find even in this body, even in this life, that we are not affected by the material world. And we see simply Krishna everywhere. Premanjana charita bhakti vilojanena santasa daiva vidayeshu vilokayanti yamshama sundara vajinta gunasrupa. That when Ramananda Roy said to Lord Chaitanya, I see you as Krishna, I see you as Radha Krishna, he said, oh, you see Krishna everywhere. It's you, you always see Krishna.
Doesn't count.
Whereas if we have these things as separate from Krishna, now here's my time for Krishna, and here's what motivates me. Here's my time for Krishna, and here's how I take care of myself and others. Here's my time for Krishna, and here's how I create things. Here's my time for Krishna, here's how I destroy things. Here's my time for Krishna, here's my morality and ethics. Then we're not seeing things as they are.
Could that be compared to like a Kanishtha attitude?
Well, definitely it's a Kanishtha attitude, but it can persist even into the Madhyam Bhakta. Yes. Ultimately, we want to come to the Uttam platform, where whatever we're doing, whatever we're thinking, wherever we're going, whatever we're engaged in, we're all connecting that with Krishna. And we do that most effectively through stories. We do that most effectively through stories. The stories we tell others and the stories we tell ourselves. So, you know, we say that we have a secular society. Do you know what we mean by secular? It means that you explain the world without reference to religion or God. How you interpret the world. Basically, the stories you tell about the facts in the world. The news isn't just facts. It's stories about the facts. It's our interpretation of the facts. There's a huge difference between the facts and what we decide those facts mean. We're all sitting in this room. We could all give a similar series of facts about what's happening right now. But what is happening, what meaning what's happening right now has, is vastly different. I mean, if you think about different cultures, right? So in America, our culture is that we don't impose anything on somebody that they don't want. People should be very self-directing and independent, isn't that? Right? So if someone comes to your house for dinner in America, you may have a buffet they can just serve with themselves what they want. And you ask them, would you like some bread? And if they say no, you don't give them any bread. And you might ask them a second time, but you're not going to ask them much more than that. Whereas in Japan, you're supposed to say no. Would you like some bread? Oh, no, 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 no. You sure would you like some bread? No, no, no. Would you like some bread? No, no, no. Here, just take some bread. Right? And those of us, you know, who've been to India, we find they just simply put the food on our plate. So for us who've been brought up in America, that's very disrespectful. You would never go to a guest and just put food on their plate. That would be disrespectful. But in India, that's how you show respect. Because in India, you're supposed to anticipate the need of your guests without them having to ask. That's respectful. Hari Velazpuru tells a very funny story. His parents, his family is from Armenia. So when they first came to America, their neighbors invited them over for dinner. So his Armenian family goes to the neighbor's house, and they're sitting down, and then the neighbors say, everything's ready. Are you hungry? Oh, no, 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 no. We don't need to eat. Well, are you sure everything's ready? No, 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 it's okay. Well, all right then. And the neighbors just sat down and right in front of their guests ate their dinner.
All right.
You know? Whereas when I've eaten at Indian's house, often the hosts aren't even eating. They won't even eat. They won't eat after you've left. You know? They'll make you sit down and they'll put food on your plate. So what does something mean, is my point. You know, what happens is someone says, no, no, no. What does no, no, no mean? Does it mean yes or no? So it's not the facts. It's the meaning that we ascribe to the facts. And we, each of us, ascribe different meanings to facts dependent on our upbringing, our particular conditioning, the culture that we're in, and so forth. So secularism is you see the world and you the meaning that you give the world is that God is absent. So what we are meant to do is we are meant to have Shastra Chakshus, the eyes of the Bhagavatam. The Bhagavatam is supposed to become our eyes so that we understand what is happening in the world. We understand my personal life story, the life story of my family members, the life story of the people in my greater community, and the whole life story of the planet in terms of Krishna and in terms of the Bhagavatam. And when we do that, then we become Jivan Mukta. We become liberated, not in the sense of merging into the Brahman, but in the sense of feeling ourselves, as Bhaktivinoda so nicely says in Jivan Dharma, feeling ourselves so much part of Krishna's pastimes right now. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, we find exaltation in our life because we see this whole material world, the creation and destruction, as also one of Krishna's pastimes. So thank you very much. Questions, comments, corrections, additions, subtractions.
In what context is Shukadev?
He's establishing that Krishna is the Supreme Lord, that Krishna is the avatari of all the avatars, that Krishna is the source of Narayan. And he's doing this because he wants to establish that Lord Chaitanya and Krishna have the same identity and that therefore Lord Chaitanya is also avatari. By the way, for everybody else, that was a very important question. Why was Gaurangi Priya's question very important? What is the context?
Why was her question important?
Yes, why is that a very important question in general for anything that we read or hear from the Shastra or our Acharyas or our Guru?
In relationship to what you're speaking about, because there's all pastime stories, Krishna Das Kaviraj is writing his Chaitanya Charitamrita for a specific reason.
Okay. The reason that he's writing. Why is it important, though, to always ask the context of anything we hear from Guru Sadhu Shastra? Yeah?
So you know the story, because we remember the stories.
Oh, very nice, because then we'll know the stories, we'll remember the stories. I like that. That's a very good answer, because as I was saying, all the philosophy is part of stories, and what's attractive to us is stories. So if we remember how the philosophy is in a story, we'll be much more likely to remember the philosophy. That's... Thank you. I wouldn't have thought of that, but that was perfect reply. Why else do we need to know the context?
Does
depending on the context, it can mean a different thing.
Oh, and it does mean a different thing depending on the context.
Like people play the Prabhupada says game all the time.
Yes, yes. In fact, the vast majority, you call it a game, I call it a battle. You know, I have this mental imagery of people having, you know, different weapons made out of different quotes. You know,
the
ostras. This ostras. I have my this
morning walk ostras.
I have my morning walk ostras. Yeah.
We're not from ostras.
All right, I'm going to make my philosophical point to prove that I am right and you are wrong. I mean, I once got a very sadly funny email from a godbrother saying, you know, the way I understand the Shastra is this is the way, this is what the Shastra means. That's what Krishna says. And I said, Prabhu, is that what Krishna says or is that your understanding of what Krishna says? He says, there's no difference between what Krishna says and my understanding of what Krishna says. Well, okay. That was sort of the end of that discussion. So, because the vast majority of the statements of Guru Sadhu Shastra are contextually true and not trans-contextually true. There are very, very few statements that are trans-contextually true. So like Yamuna said, everything Prabhupada said was perfect. That's a fact. But everything Prabhupada said was perfect in context. Just like Prabhupada was criticized for saying that Hitler was a gentleman. But that was in a context. He said he could have developed the atomic bomb and used it, but he didn't.
Right. Or he compared it to Churchill.
Yes. So, look, we have quotes from Hiranyakashipu in our Shastra.
Shri.
Don't we quote Hiranyakashipu's philosophy? Kamsa teaches philosophy, Hiranyakashipu teaches philosophy, and the philosophy they teach is good. Does that mean that Hiranyakashipu was altogether a nice man? Kamsa acted like a gentleman very briefly. Yeah, didn't he?
Yeah, yes.
When he apologized to Devaki, and we could say, when he acted like that, he was a gentleman. But it's in context. Was he overall a gentleman? No. So, you know, the things that... What about when Krishna talks to Nandamarsh about Govardhan Lila? Is that going to be our guiding philosophy in life? Is that... It's spoken by Krishna. It's in the Bhagavatam. It's Krishna's words. It's in the Bhagavatam. Do we say that, you know, this philosophy that Krishna taught, is this our main principle? Or I like to give the example that Krishna tells Arjuna, for those who have been honored, dishonor is worse than death. Then he also says, what are you caring about this honor and dishonor for? So many times in Bhagavad Gita, he says several times, I should count them, at least three or four times, where Krishna says you should be equal poised in honor and dishonor.
Yeah.
So how are both of those statements true? They're each true in context. But no, neither of those statements is trans-contextually true because otherwise you'd have a contradiction. Or in chapter 8, Srila Prabhupada says that one can worship any form of the Lord. He says one can fix one's mind on any form of the Lord. And he lists some Ram, the Singh, and so forth. I can't remember the verse for that one. In 1865, Srila Prabhupada says one should only fix one's mind on Krishna playing his flute and one should not divert one's attention to any other form like Ram, the Singh. So I once brought this up to a devotee as an example of the fact that you cannot take all of Srila Prabhupada's statements literally transcontextually. I said these two statements cannot both be absolutely transcontextually true. And he said, oh yes they can. I said, well how can they? One purport says you should fix your mind on any incarnation such as Ram and Nisinga. And the other purport says do not divert your attention to Ram and Nisinga. Now how do I fix my mind on Nisingadev if I can't divert my attention to Nisingadev? It's impossible. You can't do it. It's completely contradictory. But it's within context. Now you could give an interpretation of how they're both transcontextually true. Say reference to Manashiksha, that when I'm meditating on Nisingadev I see here's Krishna in Nisingadev. Here's Krishna as Ramachandra. But that's not the words that Srila Prabhupada used. Srila Prabhupada didn't give that way of merging those two statements. So you say, well, this is true in context. I mean, if we took 1865 purport as literally true, we would not be able to observe Nrisimha Chaturdasi. You'd not be able to have a picture of Nrisimhadeva on your altar. You wouldn't even be able to worship Lord Chaitanya because he's not playing flute. Do you all follow what I'm saying? Yes? So there are some trans-contextual statements that are true for all living entities in all times and in all places, always. Can you think of what kind of statements? And those aren't very many, by the way. What kind of statements would those be? Yes? This is the Supreme Lord, everyone else is his servant. Any other statements that are just there? You can remove them from their context and they're always absolutely true.
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna,
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare
Rama. Always remember Krishna. Always remember Krishna, never forget it. Jivaya Swarupaya Krishna. Jivaya Swarupaya
Krishna. Survive from some part of the world.
Yes. Or where Krishna says, if you give up all religion, then I'll take care of you. Mm-hmm. Now, you couldn't give that instruction to everybody. Not everybody's ready to hear Sarvadharma and Pratyajna. Mm-hmm. But the principle that if you Sarvadharma and Pratyajna, and may come Sharanam Pratyajna, that principle is always true. That if you're willing to do that, that you'll get that protection. And that's true for everyone at all times and all places. And everything else had better be understood in context. In fact, it says here, right, that things should be done... Was it? According to the time, was it in the verse or the purport? It was in the purport. Anyway, there was a mention here according to time, place, object.
Yeah.
Although I can't find that yet. So yeah, these things are described directly and indirectly according to time, place, and object. In fact, one of the 14 elements of knowledge is knowing time, place, and circumstance and being able to adjust according to time, place, and circumstance. I read someone's post on Facebook the other day that why devotees, when they preach to some audiences, you know, they present the philosophy a little differently. I thought, because they're intelligent. Prabhupada did. Narada Muni did. Krishna does. You know, there's almost an identical verse spoken to the gopis and to the brahmanas' wives. You know that? When they come. Mm. Yes?
When you are on the other side of receiving an instruction for a particular time, circumstance, so can you say that this is absolute for you in one sense?
Absolute for you in all of your lifetimes, forever, in all eternity? Probably not. Most of the instructions you're going to receive from guru and sadhus are not in that category. You know, if I say, please get me a glass of water, that doesn't mean that that's your eternal service in the spiritual world, that in our spiritual bodies you are eternally, you know, I'm a sake and you're my manjari and you're always bringing me glasses of water. That's not... You know, and even if that's your service, you're not doing that constantly. It's not that you just give a glass of water all the time and you never do any other variety of activities.
In terms of like service, like Prabhupada from the spiritual master, go preach to the Western.
So does that mean you have to preach in the Western? You know, there aren't going to be Western countries in the next creation of Lord Brahma, necessarily. When Gopakumar came back to the Earth planet, he said everything was changed except for the Dham. Krishna says material nature is endlessly mutable.
And Prabhupada preached in India, so was he fine?
Prabhupada also preached in India.
Spiritual master's instruction by
Durga. I mean, I know of some devotees, at least I know one devotee, that Prabhupada gave this devotee an instruction in the 1970s to stay at this temple and do such and such service, and that devotee took it, well, now I have to do that for the rest of my life. And I'm not sure if that was an accurate understanding. But I know other devotees. I mean, I know Bir Krishna Swami was told by Prabhupada to preach in South America, which he's not doing practically at all anymore. He understood that as a very time, place, circumstance instruction. So if you're not sure, ask the person who's giving you the instruction. Is this something that applies now and after death and at every moment of my life, or is this something that applies to me now? And in general, there's, you know, the best thing. And then there's the best thing for me, and then there's the best thing for me now. Like Rupa Goswami says, the best place to live is Radhakund. So should we close all of our temples and everybody go live at Radhakund? Not only would we totally disrupt all the ecosystem at Radhakund, I mean, it would be pretty much a catastrophe. But what about all of our preaching? Would that please Prabhupada and Bhaktisiddhanta and Rupa Goswami? And are we really, is it good for all of us to live at Radhakund? Would that even be spiritually healthy for us? Maybe for some people now, but for all of us? I mean, we do have a temple at Radhakund. We have an ISKCON temple at Radhakund. Some devotees live there. Or you could say sannyas is the best ashram. Should everybody take sannyas when they're 5 and just skip the other 3 ashrams? Does that make sense? So, you know, instruction is going to change. Most instruction that we receive from guru and sadhus is contextual. Frankly, one of the reasons that the Ritvic philosophy is dangerous is that it removes the time, place, and circumstance of the guru. There are several reasons why one should take initiation from somebody who's personally present on the planet. I mean, one very obvious reason is if you say you accept them, how in the world do you know that they accept you? You know, you can't, like we just had a wedding here, but if my granddaughter decided she was going to marry some movie star and just put his poster there, you know, I don't think that he would agree. He'd say, well, I haven't married this person. So that's one obvious reason. But another reason, which may not be so obvious, is that the guru, you need gurus who can give instruction according to time, place, and circumstance. And it changes. It changes. Even here we're talking about the manvan avatars, the manus who give instructions for mankind. But if you tried to take the laws of Manu from the Manu Samhita and copy-paste them into 2016, it wouldn't work. It wouldn't be favorable for bhakti. It wouldn't be favorable for remembering Krishna. And Prabhupada said that. He said, you can't follow the Manu Samhita. He said, according to Manu Samhita, you know, you're all malechas and yavanas. I mean, not all of us, obviously. But he said, how are you going to follow it? So that's one reason why they're, just like Srila Prabhupada has given these purports in reference to the time when he wrote them. And he referenced things going on in the world at that time. So even though they're the law books for 10,000 years, Prabhupada wanted his disciples to write books. Why? Prabhupada said, everything's there in my books. Yes? And he also said, all of you should write every day. He said, all of my disciples should write at least 2 lines every day. And all of you should not only publish and print my books, but you should write your own books. What's the reason for that? Because the audiences and the circumstances have changed. I mean, one of the things I've noticed as a preacher is with Varnashram, that Varna is a very easy thing to preach about in 2016. If you want to talk about that we should have a career that's according to our nature, that's according to our personality and our interests and our proclivities and our talents, and that career should be used as a form of sacrifice and worship for the Lord and for the benefit and in harmony, that the career you do shouldn't just be to make money for yourself and get, you know, a Jaguar and a BMW and a flat screen TV in every room, but the career you do should be as a steward. You should be a protector of ideas and knowledge, or a protector of people, or a protector of the natural resources and wealth, or protector of the arts and functions in society. You shouldn't be an exploiter. That's something that the vast majority of people on earth are willing and eager to hear. But if you start talking about the ashrams, you're not going to get much receptivity. If you start saying, okay, people should get married by the time they're 20, we should have compulsory marriage, Prabhupada says, by age 24 for the men, 16 for the women. I mean, that's going to go over really big, isn't it? And then people, when they get married, should have children. That's another one, you know. Children? I don't want any children. I just want my career. People aren't going to be interested in that. And then when you get to middle age, you should renounce. Oh yeah, I'm going to renounce and marry somebody else. You know, that's their... They're not going to be interested in that. I mean, you can talk about some things with the ashram, but you try to talk about grihastha life nowadays, I mean, people aren't just... They're not... They're going to leave. They're just going to turn around and walk out the door. So I see that this is very time, place, and circumstance. Varna, you could preach a lot about Varna. Ashram, you know, you're speaking to people who are 3 times divorced with kids from all different relationships, and what are you going to tell them? I mean, I know of some places in ISKCON where they'll tell, you know, some 38-year-old divorced person, you have to either move into the Brahmachari ashram or get married again, otherwise you're not properly situated in the varnas. And you can't perform bhakti until you're properly situated in the varnas. So it's not going to work, is it? It's just not going to be effective. So if we emphasize that in our preaching, we're going to drive away most people in society. Does that make sense to everybody? Mm-hmm. You could have done that back in the 1940s. Mm-hmm. You could have had an emphasis on ashram in the 1940s. But I don't see that you could do it now. You'll lose your audience in the first 2 minutes. You can talk about that after people have been devotees for 10 years, but even most people who have been devotees for 10 years, their ashram situation is nuts. How many of our devotees have a sane ashram situation, isn't it? Not very many. So therefore, there has to be, you know, gurus and sadhus and teachers always on the planet who can present Krishna consciousness very expertly. Or we see like the Goswamis. The Goswamis, hundreds of years ago, they were writing books of intimate Krishna lila without philosophy. You're all aware of this. Srila Prabhupada didn't do that. Prabhupada only presented lila in the context of philosophy. You look at Krishna book, it's an interweaving of lila and philosophy. So obviously the Goswamis could write for an audience different than Prabhupada's audience. And we feel fine to give out Krishna book to meat-eating, liquor-drinking, sex-mongering people in the public, correct? But we would never go out to the public and distribute, you know, Govinda Lilamrita. And it wouldn't be appropriate. Okay, thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Krishna Das Kaviraj ki jai.
One question?
Yes, please.
So, Prabhupada said that his books will be the law books for the next coming 10,000 years.
Yes.
So how do we understand that? Would he still continue distributing his books?
I hope so. Although, who knows if people will still be speaking English in 10,000 years. But the society that demonstrates Prabhupada's books and the devotees that teach Srila Prabhupada's books, Prabhu, will radically change. I mean, if we expect to have a golden age, won't that have to be a pretty radical change from the current society? What would that look like exactly? Does anybody know exactly what that will look like?
Some war.
Well, you're talking about the process of change. But the society itself. If right now all of Michigan were in Mahaprabhu's movement, what would that look like? Okay. Do you know? You know, I asked this question at the European Leaders meeting in Europe. Actually, I asked it in the context of women because they asked me, they kind of forced me to give a presentation on women in ISKCON. And the first question I asked is, I said, suppose all of Europe or all your country was fully in Mahaprabhu's movement, what would women be doing? And I didn't realize that nobody had thought about that question before, and so I got very peculiar answers from these leaders in Europe, kind of embarrassing answers, actually. I said, what would women be doing in terms of basically varna ashram and bhakti? And the main thing that jumped out at me from their responses was that nobody ever talked about this. Nobody was doing any visioning exercises. Another thing that jumped out at me is that there was a huge disconnect between their vision of what women would be doing in a Krishna conscious society and how we actually engage women practically now in the Hare Krishna movement. There was almost no relationship between the two whatsoever. Another thing that jumped out at me was, thank God we're not running the world. With the visions that they came out with. I mean, if I were to repeat them, you'd all be so embarrassed and angry. It was just really, very...
Leaving your bodies on fire.
Well, the only three careers they came up with was mother, princess, and prostitute. Okay, so it was very disturbing. It was really very disturbing. And I thought, well, you know, thank God we're not running the world if this is our vision for women in a Krishna-conscious society. But my point in bringing this up is what will the world look like under Mahaprabhu's banner? These are very thoughtful leaders that I asked this question of, and they really didn't know. They hadn't really thought of it. And even if they had thought of it, I remember I was asked by the strategic planning team for the GBC to write a job description for the GBC based on Srila Prabhupada's instructions. So I spent a lot of time with Jai Krishna Prabhu of New Vrindavan and some other people on the succession committee combing through all of Srila Prabhupada's instructions to the GBC, which was a fascinating exercise. But I was asked by the head of the SBT, Agopa Bhatta Prabhu, write something that will be good for 300 years. I said, I can't do that. I told him that 30 years ago, if I had been asked to envision what ISKCON would look like now, I would not have described it as it is. And I doubt if very many other people would have either. I don't even know what ISKCON's going to look like 30 years from now. Or the whole Gaudiya society, or the world. I really don't have a clue. Material nature is endlessly mutable. So you can have law books, but how will they be presented? How will they be lived? What will be emphasized?
I just want to make the point that law books are actually changed, too.
Yeah, law books do get changed.
We don't use law books from 100 years ago.
That's true.
And law books are not read by the common people.
That's also true.
The common people live by the letter of the law, but not because they read the book.
Right. That's true. That's true. So how this will play out, Prabhu? You know what my answer is? I haven't the foggiest idea. And I don't believe anyone else does either, except for, you know, Lord Chaitanya and Lord Nityananda and Advaita Acharya.
I don't have a foggiest idea. Maybe it's not the most important instruction to worry about.
Well, I think Prabhupada did give some indication that it wouldn't be that we buy the material ladder-climbing ways of the world today.
Yes.
Attain power. It would be that people want us to lead them.
That's
by
true.
An exemplary culture that we present. They come to us and say, okay, we're in trouble. What do we do?
A teaching society. I mean, I think it's very very useful, extremely useful to do visioning exercises looking ahead a short distance.
Yeah. 5 years.
5 years, 10 years. You know, that kind of thing in any kind of leadership and management is extremely important. As long as you keep in mind that your visioning exercise is not creating the future. Because if you don't do any visioning for where you're going, if you don't know where you're going, you probably won't get there. You know, if you don't have any kind of vision for the future, then you don't know how to train the devotees right now. Just like a child in school, you don't know exactly what they're going to do when they grow up. But you have some idea of what they're probably going to do. So if we had a Krishna conscious society, I mean, some of the things that come to my mind is I look at something like Bhaktivedanta Hospital. And I say, you know, if we had a Krishna conscious society, then there'd be a lot of vegetarian prasadam restaurants. There wouldn't be just one or two Govindas here and there. You know, there'd be as many Govinda type restaurants as there are now Domino's pizzas and McDonald's and things like that. The healthcare providers would be devotees. I heard there was a meeting in Gita Nagari a year ago of the healthcare professionals who are devotees.
And doing it again this year.
Very nice. So there would be, I see that the professions, as I talked about Varna, I see that Varna is something we could definitely do in the world. That people's occupations would start to become God-centered. Another thing that I would see happening is an increase in kirtan, which is already happening, as a prime religious practice. You know, another thing is which we're already going in this direction, is dealing with living entities in terms of equality of souls. This is another prime direction that the world is already moving in. Going much more towards a more natural, ecological way of life. Again, this, I see the societies already... Yeah, I see the society is already moving in this direction. I mean, we have some devotees in Europe and some also in America who are selling ahimsa milk products. So the move from just organic to ahimsa, I see as a big trend in the world. You know, I think we could see a trend towards more children. I think there's going to be a trend away from abortion and birth control.
And abortion's gone down.
Yes, and people's, you know, view about abortion and birth control is also gone down. So these are some things that we could have as a general, but especially the spiritualization of occupation, I see as something that, and occupation according to nature, as something that we would see in society. Yeah, and you can see that the remnants of it in India, Krishna's laundry, you know, Krishna's laundromat, and right? Balaji's bakery. And
Krishna articles about Balaji's liquor.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Bhaktinanda Arulhenics.
Unfortunately. Exactly. So that's something that I could see. I don't think we have to have a doomsday scenario.
Yeah.
Mm. In fact, I just presented a paper recently in Harvard. We had a conference on 50 years of ISKCON, and I was asked to present a paper on the history of education. So in doing the research, I realized that in Hawaii, I still had my papers, and that I have the Ministry of Education bulletins and letters, which probably, I wouldn't be surprised if I'm the only one in the world who has that stuff. Unfortunately, a lot of it I got rid of some years ago. But I had all these files. So I found the prospectus from the Vrindavan Gurukul, written by Jagadish, who was that time, wrote Jagadish Das Vanachari. So it must have been pre-81. It didn't have any date. Most of these papers had no date on them. But we know that this was... You know, these newsletters that say, so in January, what year... You know, and you have to try to place it by your own knowledge what was going on. But what he wrote in the prospectus is, we are intentionally not educating our children to go to higher education or function in the world. We are not going to give them an education that will allow them to function in the world or go on to an institute of higher education. Why? Because we're sure that pretty soon the whole society is going to be destroyed.
Wow.
It was heavy. I thought it was really... really heavy. That was intense. And then the Vrindavan prospectus from a few years later, when Dhanadhar Swami was in charge, when Jagadish had left and Dhanadhar Swami was in charge, was a little bit better. The prospectus said something like, you know, we're going to prepare the children to function as in a Varnashram situation and as to fulfill some things in a Vaishnav society. And a few years after that, I was finding descriptions from schools in the West that were saying we're going to prepare our students to work in the world. And, you know, Jagadish, one of the reasons that he resigned as the Minister of Education is he wrote papers to the GBC and he said, I've been preparing the students for a society that doesn't exist and doesn't look like it will exist. And I've become very hopeless at where our children and where our families are going to fit into society and how they're going to maintain themselves. So I would really caution against doomsday scenarios. You know, when you go to apocalyptic and doomsday scenarios, what you tend to do is not function very sanely on a day-to-day basis. You know.
More out of a sense of abdicating responsibility for the dead.
Yes, you get into kind of this mode of ignorance thing, and then you start putting your energy into stockpiling cans and weapons and that
water purifiers
and that kind of, and we've had devotees get into this.
No, so. I love your work.
And then you do not functioning as they are. And, you know, most change happens gradually. I mean, it's just as plausible that a golden age would involve technology on some level. That's just as plausible. You know, we're using communication technology in Krishna's service.
Yeah, we're not going to develop telepathy anymore.
Yeah, and to imagine that the future means that all of us are going to go back to just traveling by ox cart all over the world, that may not be the case. We may turn more to solar power and wind power and things like that. But, you know, material nature is endlessly mutable. So exactly how the golden age works out and how it will manifest and what elements of what we see today in technology is going to remain is very hard to say. But anyway, some kind of visioning is very useful. I mean, what I told the group of leaders is if you think all the women should be wives and mothers, then why don't we have more matchmaking services in our movement to help people find good spouses? Why don't we have more training for the Grihastha Ashram? Why don't we have, you know, more schools for our children? If you think that all the women should be mothers, then maybe every temple should have a school. That might be a good idea. You know, why don't we welcome children in our temples? Why don't we celebrate large families? I said, we're not doing any of those things.
Why don't we have changing tables in the bathrooms?
Why don't we have changing tables? There you go. Why don't we have changing tables in the bathrooms? There you go. Why, when I presented a GBC resolution that every new temple construction should build a room for the parents with young children, why was that voted down by the GBC?
Oh, really?
Yeah. So if your vision for the future, you know, if your vision for a Krishna-conscious society is all the women are going to have babies, then... why don't them, if you really believe, I said, if you really believe that, if that's really your vision, then it would be wise right now to start moving in that direction and support the women who already are mothers. That would be a nice thing. Or support the women who would like to be mothers.
Give them some hope.
Help them find a good husband. Help the men in the movement prepare to be good husbands. Give support for grahastha life, right? That would make sense. So I think, if you start looking 10,000 years from now, it becomes a little ridiculous, or even 200 years from now. But if you want to start looking 5, 10 years from now, then it becomes a much saner thing to do. If we want to institute Varnashram, if we see that, then let's look at Varna and how can I help everyone to find their career, not just keep them in the Brahmacharya ashram until they're 35 just washing pots. I mean, I know of a temple where they give the Brahmacharis no training for a livelihood, although Prabhupada said in the second canto the Gurukul means specific training for a livelihood. But they give them no training for a livelihood, and then and they tell them, stay Brahmachari as long as you possibly can. And when the poor Brahmachari is finally exploding at about 35 or 38, I can't take it anymore, then their rule is you have 1 month after you decided to change ashram and you have to move out. So we've given you no training, no time, no facility, no money for any career training. None at all, even though that's what the Brahmachari ashram is meant for, among other things. And then we try to push you to stay Brahmachari way past the time that you were supposed to get married.
It's exploitation.
It's exploitation, yes. It's just wanting a cheap workforce. We try to keep you Brahmachari, 10, 20 years after Prabhupada says you should move into the grahastha ashram or prepare for the sannyas ashram. And then as soon as you figure out, my God, I need to get married, we're going to throw you out. So a little bit of visioning would be helpful in this regard. A little bit of thinking, what is a Krishna conscious... If we could make the world Krishna conscious right now, without bombing all the buildings, without a war, without an economic collapse. Just like Srila Prabhupada had said that he predicted there'd be a war between America and Russia. He said, unless Russia takes up Krishna consciousness, and what's happened is Russia's become a fertile ground for devotional service, and that war was averted. So. Is that all right? Hare Krishna.